Good morning, you all.
Pretty weak.
Nice to see such a group of bright-eyed, bushy-tailed individuals. This is a refreshing change for me. I'm used to teaching 8 o'clock classes where students are bleary-eyed and bushed. After one of my characteristically brilliant lectures at the seminary some time ago, one of the students came up at the conclusion of the hour and said, "Prof, that was fantastic. Superb." He said, "I think you are the most brilliant professor I have ever had." I thought he was pouring it on. But particularly when he added, "I really think you are more brilliant than Einstein." And I fell directly into the trap by asking him, "Oh, really? How's that?" Well, he said, "They tell me that there were only 10 men in the world who could understand Einstein, and I don't think there's anyone who can understand you." So I wanted you to know I'm eminently qualified today to talk on the subject of communication. It's always a joy to return to the Glen, to any Navigator group, but I must confess this morning, I am greatly honored at the privilege you have accorded me this week, and I want you to know I do not view the assignment lightly, and have been much in prayer that the Spirit of God will light some fires in this conference that will never go out. It is my sincere hope that the Navigators will never be the same as a result of the time that we have spent together. Ayn Rand, noted novelist, was lecturing at Yale Divinity School some time ago in an attempt to infect young minds with her prickly, and I might add, pernicious ideas. At the conclusion of one of her lectures, she was interviewed by a reporter from Time magazine who asked her, "Miss Rand, what's wrong with the modern world?" And without a moment's hesitation, she replied, "Never before has the world been clamoring so desperately for answers to crucial problems. And never before has the world been so frantically committed to the idea that no answers are possible." To paraphrase the Bible, she said, the modern attitude is, "Father, forgive us, for we know not what we are doing. And please don't tell us." Ladies and gentlemen, it is to such a generation that God has called you and me to communicate. To a generation in which everything nailed down is coming loose. And the miracle of the ministry is that God chose you to communicate to this generation. I hope you never recover from that realization and responsibility. Now, if you are talking more but enjoying it less, you may be on the verge of the most significant breakthrough in your ministry. Nothing is so easy as talking. Nothing is so difficult as communication. I talk to many people. I teach very few. Those I teach, I change. And it seems to me that most of us as evangelicals are overly impressed indeed frequently enamored of our speaking, with the result that we have become insensitive to the importance of the listener. Communication is a two-way street. What you do as a speaker is largely determined by what the people do that hear you. The test is not what did you say, but what do they understand? What do they do as a result of what you say? Communication is one of the most delicate and difficult tasks ever to confront the human mind. And the first thing I want to do this morning is to make you a believer. I want to give you a healthy respect for the process of communication so that you will never again get up on your feet without praying or divine enablement. I was riding on a plane a few years back. I sat down next to a man who looked very familiar and soon discovered it was Alec Guinness. I engaged him in conversation and I picked his brain. I said I would be interested to know what it is that constitutes, from your standpoint, the secret of communication. Thought for a moment, and then said, the wonderment that people will come to listen to me. You ever get up before a group? It matters not if you have 3 or 300. And begin with the idea, how fortunate can you get to come hear me speak? You've had it. You're already on the tubes. The wonder of it, that someone will listen. And whatever you do or do not do in your ministry, you cannot afford to fail here. For failure in communication is fatal. The Apostle Paul underscores the paramount importance of communication in the spiritual realm. In 1 Corinthians chapter 14, and I want to read a few verses. I wish we had time to study this passage in detail. We do not. It's very interesting in these days of charismatic emphasis that evangelicals are often avoiding the very passages they ought to invade. We're so afraid that we are often grossly ignorant. And in the midst of this passage dealing with tongues, Paul has some pertinent things to say about the real issue in tongues, namely communication. In verse 8 he says, "For if the trumpet gives an uncertain sound, who shall prepare himself to the battle?" If I were to write one word over our generation, I would write the word confusion. That exists outside the church doesn't bother me. But that it exists within the church ought to stab you awake this morning. God called us to be fishers of men, not keepers of aquariums. God called us to dispense truth, not to bottle it. But our great greatest lack is a lack of leaders. A leader is a man who knows where he's going and is able to persuade others to go along with him. I saw an interesting cartoon in the Dallas Morning News some time ago. It was a picture of a large crowd of people going over the hill, and the man is standing here talking to another individual, and he excused himself. He said, "I'm sorry, I have to leave. I gotta hurry up and catch up with the group. I'm their leader." So likewise ye. Except ye utter by the tongue words easy to be understood, how shall it be known what is spoken? For you shall speak into the air. There are, it may be, so many kinds of voices in the world, and none of them is without signification. Therefore, if I know not the meaning of the voice, I shall be unto him that speaketh a barbarian. And he that speaketh shall be a barbarian unto me. Nothing worse than two barbarians, particularly in the same group. Even so ye, for as much as ye are zealous of spiritual gifts, seek that ye may excel to the edifying of the church. You want to excel? Excel in edification. Communication. Verse 19. Yet in the church I had rather speak five words with my understanding, that by my voice I might teach others also. Good navigator principle, isn't it? Than 10,000 words in an unknown tongue. Paul was not enamored of words. He'd rather reduce the quantity to improve the quality, if by so doing he taught. He caused people to learn. Now, this morning in our first hour, and to a certain extent in our second, I would like to give you an overview of the communication process. There are seven significant steps. Steps that you must learn to identify and then seek to improve. The first place, and the place at which we begin in communication, that which we call the concept feeling. The greatest breakthrough in the science of communication came with the realization that communication is more than an intellectual process. We still have to catch up with this in the church. We are over-intellectualizing the process of communication. We think if we can just get people to say the right words, to believe the right truths, we'll have it made. And nothing is more ridiculous. The result is you have people who know all of the shibboleths, all of the cliches, and are sterile. Communication not only involves the mind, and it does involve that, it also involves the emotions, how I feel toward a given concept. And it certainly involves the will. What I will do because I know this, believe this. Therefore, I respond to it. Now, this is your problem in second-generation Christians. These are people who have accurate beliefs but not personal convictions. And there's a vast difference. A belief is something you can hold intellectually. A conviction is something you do not hold. It holds you. This is the thing you not only die for, you'll live for. This is the thing that absorbs all of your life. This is why you've probably had somebody say to you, if you're a good Nav, you're kind of a nut, aren't you? Don't look at me that way. You ever have anybody say that? That's unfortunate. We better start examining this crap. You sold out to this thing. You sleep it. You breathe it. You eat it. This is it. And the interesting thing is that I can sit down with this person, man to man, tell him exactly what I believe, even tell him how I feel, even tell him what I'm doing. And he writes it all down in his little book and says, tremendous. And you know what he does? He walks out and he tells the next guy, this is what you believe, this is how you feel, and dope. Got it? Yeah. Very interesting to see this at work in my students. Let's suppose I want to communicate the importance of using visual aids as a means of facilitating the process of getting ideas across. If I simply tell my students, use visual aids, they are very important. Jesus used them. All great teachers use them. You use them. What they do? They walk out and they get up in a class and they say, use visual aids. They're very important. Everybody uses them. Believe it, I attended a workshop not too long ago, 1 hour and 15-minute workshop on audio visuals, and there wasn't one audio visual. By the way, it is this reason why repetition is so essential to teaching. That's a paralyzing fear of a young person. He's scared to death to repeat himself. And that's why he communicates so little. Did you ever meet Doss? Did you ever know him? Did it ever occur to you why it is there are so many people who have had personal contact with him on the staff who repeat repeatedly the things that he repeated? This is an accident. It's tied into another factor, and that is the time is essential for the development of this concept feeling. That's why you need repeated exposures and over a period of time, because you don't get it all the first time. I mean, you think you do. You got all down in the notes, but you don't have very much, except a set of notes. How does this become a conviction to you? How does this charge you? How does this commit you? Repeated exposure over time. You see, to me, there is a difference between spirituality and maturity. A person can be spiritual 5 minutes after he receives Christ as a Savior. He cannot be mature. Maturity demands time, a process of development. And you can't telescope it. And what we want to do is take what it took us X number of years to get and pour it all into this guy tonight, preferably day before yesterday. Do you ever notice how impatient people are, particularly the person that it's taken so long to get where he is? I mean, how long have you been in Ruth? Well, about 12 years. But boy, he just has no patience with this guy. How come you don't see it? Let's get with it. I want him to see it right now. That's an impossibility. It takes time. And the more exposure he gets to this, and the more this becomes his personal property, the more he gets charged by it, and then it becomes his conviction. The second step. That of word. There is no such thing as communication apart from words. You ever have a person tell you, well, I understand it, I just can't express it. Forget it. Words are the vehicles. They're the box cars that carry the commodity. You can't think without words. And we get all hung up with these, despite the fact that they are the building blocks of literature, of speech. Sometimes our problem is we use big words. I have been particularly amused recently because we've often used the term interaction. That sounds tremendous, doesn't it? It's almost as good as communication. So the students go out, interaction. So I'm in a workshop, and every now and then I put my hand up. I said, I beg your pardon, what was that word you used? And the guy looks at me, you know, professor, what? I got it from you. I don't know what you're talking about. It's it mean? And he, it means interaction. In fact, I suppose with all of us who've had some degree of education, you spend the first 10 years or less, if you get smarter fast, trying to impress people, you spend the rest of your life trying to instruct them. Words are essential, but they can be tremendous barriers. Not only do we use big words, but we use words with varied meaning. Trunk. What does it mean? Well, it may mean the proboscis of an elephant. May mean the back end of my car. May mean the thing I've got up in the attic that we're storing the junk in. If I'm a truck driver, it may be the main arterial highway through the middle of town called a trunk line. All kinds of meanings. The important thing is, does he or she understand how you are using this word? And the best way to get sensitive to this is working with children. In fact, I would not allow a man to graduate from seminary if I had my way without teaching nursery children. That's a liberal arts education in a hurry. You know, he comes into these kids, three or four, two or three, and he starts talking to them, and a bird lands over there on the window, and the whole audience goes over. And mind you, he's got his Greek and Hebrew, too. Loses them, just like this. See, the only difference between nursery kids and your adults is they move. But the adults are out to lunch just as much. See, they sit there and they look at me like this, like some of you are doing. Okay. But where are you? Well, you know, hundreds of miles from here, conceivably. And then the erroneous impression the children pick from words ought to be a tremendous teacher to you.
Little kid came home from Sunday school one day and he said to his mommy, "Hey, mommy, does God have ants?" "Does God have ants? Where you been?" He'd been to church. Choir sang a song that day, "The Servants of God." Kids down in Dallas were sitting on the front steps talking with each other and finally broke out in singing just before Christmas, and a news reporter came by, and what were they singing? "While shepherds wash their socks by night." Every time I sing that, that's just about ruined it now. But you sing it, and it's about what it sounds like. Or a little kid who came through, drew the picture of the Christmas scene, gets it all thing. Mom says, "Oh, fine. This one over here is obviously Joseph. That's Mary. That's right. This is little baby Jesus. Fine. Who's this fat, pudgy individual over here?" "Oh," he said, "that's Round John Virgin." Does yawn mean to a kid? And you listen to it and say a little while, and that's exactly what it sounds. He's smarter than we are. And while we sit here and laugh at this type of thing and say, "Well, that's a child, my friend," I'll take you to any audience you ever talk to, and I will take a recording of exactly what you say and interview the people that listen to you, and I will come up with precisely the same impressions from what you say. Words are vehicles. They can become bottlenecks. Third step in the process involves one you get quite sensitive to, and that's speech. These words have to be translated into verbal form. Written form. With most of us, more verbal than written. And you get all kinds of casualties here. I had a student some time ago in a course, and this old boy got up to preach, and every time he preached, he'd talk along like this, and he said, "It's wonderful, the Lord's done for us, and we really sing it." And he said, "It's praying that you turn this passage of Scripture." You know, you come up, and I'd move up further. And I said, "It's really important, quite important," he said this. You know, the reason I'm so sensitive about this used to be my problem. I came from Philadelphia, and if you do, you know the problem. And I had a music teacher who cured me of it. I took music lessons from her, and she'd give me an assignment at the end of the hour. And she said, "Now, what I'd like you to do is take this number and work it over and practice it for next time." I beg your pardon. "So I'd like you to take his number and work over it and practice it and be sure to come back." Until finally it dawned on me. She was making fun of me. She was talking to me the way I was talking to her. And I remember going around the campus and talking like this. You know, I used to have friends that say, "You know, Ellie, we really understand what you're talking about now." Enthusiasm. That's a very important thing. I hope you really have a lot of enthusiasm. I don't know about you, my friend. Boy, the man may be saying something I don't agree with. He may be way off base as far as I'm concerned, but I still have the highest respect for the person who gets up and who's got some excitement. There is nothing worse than an embalmer. Especially with the word. And this guy gets up, and you know what I feel like doing? I feel like shouting from the back row, "Hold it, Mac, hold it. Do you believe this stuff?" "Oh, yeah." "Really? I don't think so." "Yes, I do." "Okay, tell me." Now he's ready. Just get him mad.
But you know, to come up, boy, to talk to people about the very exciting things that Christ can do for you. And I'll tell you, friend, this is exactly what goes back to this. This is exactly why this guy who's just learned the words goes out to palm off the stuff and can't get excited about it. Hasn't done anything to him. As far as the people are concerned, carry him away. This also involves structure. How you say what you say. Every time you prepare to speak, you have a twofold preparation. We always prepare what we want to say. We do not often prepare how we're going to say it. The result is we talk and we talk and we talk and we say five statements, all of which can be boiled down to one statement if you know how you want to say it. That's why, you know, every now and then somebody says, oh boy, it's long. What? I came to my church some time ago. He said, oh, brother, how much time do I have? I said, 30 minutes, same thing I do. Oh, brother, I got a heavy message. I said, Mac, I got one every week. Oh, but you know, out in Africa, they listen for an hour and a half. It's wonderful, Mac, but we're in Fort Worth. And a very interesting thing was to see that when he was all through and said and done, you could have taken the whole thing and boiled it down to about 10 minutes. That's what he said. The rest is filler. Boy, I hope you're ruthless on yourself. That's why a tape recorder or something like this is a fantastic tool for evaluation. Just crucify your speaking. Cut it out. Cut it down so that when you say one statement, that's what you wanted to say. Now, the fourth step in the process gets extremely complicated. And that's what we call the distraction phase. These are distractions which take place both within the person listening and without in his environment. You ever sit in a room where it's too hot? You know, and you sit there and you start getting more soporific as the embalmer moves on? This is a good thing to stop sometimes and say, hey, you know, last night, stand up, shout, do exercises, something, open the windows. Do you ever sit in church behind a woman who took a baby there instead of to the nursery? You've been down this road before? Oh, and my favorite one is they take the baby like this and then throw him up on their shoulder to pat him while the baby looks over her shoulder. Friend, you can just block out a whole section in your audience. It's gone. This little baby sits there. And you watch the people. I have been often at a place where I feel like some... let's all stop. Everyone take a look at this cute baby over here. Madam, would you stand up, show him to everyone, laugh, try to get him response, thank you. Then add, babies are like New Year's resolutions to be carried out. You have the same thing. And don't get too pious a look on your face. Because if somebody walked in that door right now and walked over here, behind here, and went over and took that seat, I'll clue you, just about every one of you would go. And you know what you might as well do? Let us stop while Joe, watch him. Three steps, four, down. Now, back to the subject. Because you just phase out a whole segment of your audience with this type of thing. This is why the arrangement of a room is not a minor feature. And this is particularly true in nav homes.
And it's thrilling to come into an Av home every now and then where they actually arrange the room with design, even build it this way. Because all you have to do is have a guy back there, you know, behind the wall, he's listening in. You'd think so? I got news for you. He can't see you? He's out of it, probably. Very easy to plug out. You want to wrap them around you. Do you ever have the experience of going to a meeting having received some tragic news? Let's suppose before you walked in here today, one of the men here on the staff said, you got a minute, I want to share something with you, and you went off to the side. So I hate to tell you this, but so-and-so in your family just passed away. So we're going to have to make some plane arrangements for you, but there's nothing out till this afternoon. So you say, well, I'll go to the session. Maybe the Lord will, you know, speak to me too. Guess where he is during the session? Here? And a lot of you got this, and my friend, if this ever breaks through to you, this could salvage a lot of your ministry. You're working with couples, and you're talking to a couple who just had a knockdown drag-out before she finally drug up to the NAV meeting. And he's sitting there. Guess what? Boy, you got a lot of hostility to siphon off there, my friend. You're really fighting an uphill battle. In fact, there are many times that this is the very type of individual I want to get next to. I spend some time with him. I want to let him get it out of him. To say nothing of what we're going to do in counseling with his wife. We better not go into that one. There is a fifth. By the way, these guys did a fantastic job of arranging this for me, but obviously we would have put it all across the front here. This is to be one extended line. You understand? The next phase is that of listening. And you're up against a real tiger here because the average person can listen approximately 5 times as fast as you can speak, which being interpreted means they got an awful lot of time on their hands. And that's wonderful time for wool gathering, for scraping the Milky Way. Another critical problem area is what I call selective hearing. That's the person who, when he hears you, only hears what he wants to hear. So he filters out of your presentation anything that he doesn't agree with, anything that bothers him, anything that in any way threatens him, and he just hears what he wants to hear. In fact, after the meeting, he comes up and says, boy, that was terrific, man. Sure appreciate that emphasis there on working with individuals, man, that really grabbed me. You see, these folks here tonight really needed this. I'm glad they were here to hear it. It's always amusing to go home with a pastor after a meeting. Boy, sure appreciate that, Hendricks. Whew, tremendous. Just what my people needed. I had one guy some time ago, you know, that's interesting. I didn't really prepare it for them. Said, you didn't? No, for you. That's exactly why James says, receive with meekness the implanted word which is able to save your souls. The word receive means to welcome, to embrace for oneself. It's the difference between listening to a preacher and listening to a lawyer. Read a will of which you are the beneficiary. So I listen to everything the guy says. I don't care if he drones on. I mean, man, he's got a message for me. I mean, I'm in this, you know. Boy, do I listen. That's exactly the kind of listening you're trying to develop on the part of your people. And I do not think myself we throw enough of a challenge down. I think we're putting all of the responsibility on the speaker and none of the responsibility on the people. And the Word of God, in the parable of the soils, puts the responsibility upon the ground, the people that heard it. We share the responsibility. And they can't walk out and dump it on me and say, well, you know, lousy communicator. Because God is holding them responsible for listening. One thing that never ceases to intrigue me, and it'll probably happen here this week sometime, and that is in the course, sometimes just quite casually, you know, I just happened to mention I was from Philadelphia or I had an Eskimo dog when I was a boy, and that's the end of listening for some people. They come up, boy, I really appreciate it. That was terrific. I didn't know you came from Philadelphia. Yeah, I had a white dog, too. They were wonderful, weren't they? And this is particularly true with illustrations, which sometimes do not shed light. First of all, because there's nothing to shed light upon. And secondly, because they derail. And as we'll see, this is why feedback is so essential. Yeah. The next step involves that of word. You see, the first use of words involved the individual speaking. This involves the individual listening. He has to translate this into his words. His words may not be the same as your words. I don't know about you, but it still bugs me to think back to my education, to think of these individuals who used to teach classes and say, okay, write the examination. So you write the thing out. You know, C. You go back, oh, well, what's the matter? Wasn't it right? We go over the thing, you know. Well, yeah, you had the right concepts. But you didn't have the right words, which he means is his. Oh, my friend, I hope you'll get disabuse of having people parrot back your words. I don't care what the guy says in terms of what words he uses. I want to know, is he getting the concept? If he can put it in his words, terrific. I've had some thrilling times recently experimenting with inductive Bible study with teenagers, and I've turned them loose in paraphrases. I wish I had thought to bring a few of them along. I've got some of the choicest paraphrases you've ever seen. I wouldn't dare to read some of them in the average adult audience, you know. They'd rot their socks. But boy, do these kids. To get a teenager man, a guy spends hours in this passage of Scripture, juicing in it, thinking about it. Taking the vocabulary that he uses down on a high school campus and translating this stuff into something that really grabs him. Now I know what it means. And that he can use. The next step on the part of this listener to put this back into his concept, feeling, frame of reference. I mentioned to you at the outset, friend, communication is tested not by what you put into the process here, but by what comes out down here. What he thinks, how he feels, and what he does. This is why, from a motivational standpoint, I don't start with the listener, I start with the speaker. See, your problem is that you're not thinking enough. You're not feeling deeply.
you are not acting decisively. And when you do, that's what he picks up. See, you can tell me about the importance of working with individuals, but that doesn't come through until you spend a lot of time with me on an individual basis. Until every time I'm involved with you in some ministry, you're sitting down with a couple. See, then you're coming through to me loud and clear. Because that's what you do. That's what you feel. Now, we said this years ago. I mean, what you do, shout so loud I can't hear what you say. This is exactly the process. Now, there is one final phase of the process, which we call feedback. Not really a step as much as it is a means of evaluating what we have done. See, the only way I can test whether this concept feeling in any way parallels this by getting feedback. Now, if you don't want to be jolted, you just forget about this. You just keep talking. Go home and say, boy, oh boy, did I ever wow him tonight. Woo! Tremendous. They really got it. But if you ever ask him, you may discover, friend, you never even got beyond the first step. I mean, what is it you're talking about now again? What's this idea? Crazy thing. I went into a church some time ago. Would you believe it? Don't get many jolting, exciting experiences of this kind, but every now and then. Just before I went into the evening service, the pastor said, Hendrick, you won't mind if after the service we ask you some questions, will you? I said, how are we going to do this? Well, he said, when you go in tonight, you will notice that over on the side there will be a table. And tonight there will be four people sitting behind this table. There is a medical doctor. There is a housewife. There is a plumber. And there's a businessman. These are representatives from the audience. And they will take notes, as the people will, on your message. And then they will direct questions at you. And then after they're through, we'll open it up. You don't mind, do you? I mean, well, what do you say now? I thought I was moving into the millennium. This was a service started at 7:30. Service went to about 9:15. We had questions till about 10:15 when he dismissed the service. And at 1:15, I walked out of the church. And I walked out because I said, I got to go home and sleep. I got 3 speaking engagements tomorrow. I have never seen a group of people so involved. I mean, they were hanging on the edge of the chair. The place was jammed to the doors. That's a phenomenon today. To begin with, in the quote-unquote evening evangelistic hour. Why? Because you were getting some feedback. It was very interesting. I told the guy, I'll do this. You got a stenographer? He said, yeah, we'll take everything down. We'll give you a copy of it. And boy, it was one of the most searching tests I've had in a long time to find out, what do these people ask? You know what was some of the best questions come from? The plumber. He's a down-to-earth man, boy. Now, he isn't this all this jazz you're talking about, this high-powered up here. You know, how's this work on the job? Boy, tremendous. And the interesting thing is, see, they're picking your brain. This is where they compel you to get down. I just had a thrilling experience in Cleveland last summer. Got a woman started in home Bible classes. She invited a lady next door, happened to be an Episcopalian, quite a character in her own right. Very extrovertish, clubbing type of woman. I mean, she belongs to clubs. We go
got a communications problem here with words.
And so in typical fashion, this evangelical lady goes, starts the class, gets up, and, you know, runs on and on and on. The lady sits there like this, looking after she gets through, the people go home. She said, "That sure was lousy." She said, "What in the world were you talking about?" She said, "Didn't you understand what I said?" "Uh-uh." "You know, I got news for you. Neither did anybody else. Why don't you stop using all of that jargon? All of those cliches. I was saved. What do you know?" And things go on and on. "What were you talking about? Explain it." So the next week she'd come back and she'd hammer away on the thing like crazy, and after the thing, "That's better. I wish you could hear this lady give this testimony. She put it on a tape for me. I played it from my class. This unsaved woman gave her a liberal arts education as to how to communicate to an unregenerate audience. And they'd have these little skull sessions after each one." "Okay, now what did you mean by that? What's that fancy word? And why do you use this expression?" Finally, one day she says, "Well, hey, how come you spend all your time up there at the church? Aren't they Christians up there?" "Yeah." She said, "What are you spending all of your time up there with those people? We lost people are out here. Why don't you spend more time with us?" When I went back to Cleveland last year, she invited me to a dinner at which 27 people were present, each one of whom had been won to Christ in the last year as a result of this woman's class. She said, "I just wanted you to see the product of your ministry by just planting a seed in a person's idea to start some classes, but get down where they are." And she said, "Yeah, that's right. See, I have a concept feeling." She did. She had the words. "Get down where they are. That's what we're doing." So we go on with the jargon and the rest of it. Fortunately, it was a lady in a class that brought her down to where they are. I think the greatest education you can get, and as a result you can give, is that which you get from the feedback of your people. And by the way, don't always listen to your fans. See, we like those people. You know, the guy thinks I'm terrific. Oh, man, he's an insightful individual. Obviously gifted. He's deeper in the word. Really, how far under? Oh, I love some students that go right for this jugular vein. They slit it. And students are, I mean, they're proficient at it. Boy, they hammer away and back and forth with you on a class like crazy, and I walk out and I've had an education. And I don't teach that poorly again. But you can't get this unless you get this feedback, unless you talk and listen. And encourage people to talk and ask them, "What did you think? You understand what I'm talking about?" Etc. We got coffee, huh? They need it. Now, since I took a few minutes over because I wanted to get this total process before you before we go, I want you to do some noodling during this hour before you come back. I'll give you an assignment. You have problems in communication. What are they? Just run them through your mind, but get them right up in the forefront of your thinking. What are your personal problems in communication? We're thinking within the framework of the navigators. Here we are, we've got concept feelings. Trying to get them across to people. What are the problems you're facing in getting that across? We'll come back and discuss it together. Bye.